All right, Daniel chapter 11. Let's start our recap in Daniel chapter 7. Next week we'll do an entire book recap.
Because it's the last week.
What's chapter 7 of Daniel? What's the switch from 6 to 7 in your genre?
From historical narrative to dream visions?
Yeah.
Things?
Prophecy, visions, dreams. Good. Alright. Someone other than Nathan, what's the vision in Daniel chapter 7? What does he see? Yeah, animals. What do these... There's four animals. What do these four animals represent?
That's seven.
It's so different. I don't know the names.
Different, but what are they?
Say that again.
There's two cats...
Sorry, I didn't get that. I didn't
say that again.
My translator.
What do they represent?
I don't know. Enlightened.
What kinds of things do they represent?
Kingdoms.
There you go, kingdoms. Kingdoms are nations.
There we go.
Yeah, starts out with Babylon, then it advances to Medo-Persia. And then Alexander the Great comes in with the nation of Greece. And then Rome takes over after Alexander's empire breaks into
flames. I've heard that before.
Good, we talked about the little horn that comes up in the midst of the ten horns. And he's uttering boasts and waging war against the people of the Most High. And cuts off three other horns. So yeah, you need a clear picture of that vision in your mind. Remember the ten horns and then the one little horn that comes up and cuts off three horns and he's talking a whole bunch and persecuting the church or the Jews, depending on your interpretation. Chapter 8 Zoom is a vision of what two animals?
A ram and a goat.
Ram and a goat. And they represent
Medo-Persia and Greece.
Medo-Persia and Greece, respectively. The goat has... He comes in and crushes the ram, right? And he has one horn to begin with. That's Alexander the Great. That horn breaks off and is replaced by how many?
Four.
That go up towards the north... The four corners of the earth. That's the four... generals of Alexander who break up his empire, Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, Ptolemy. This is the period of history we're going to be talking a lot about tonight, called the Syrian Wars, or the Ptolemaic Seleucid Wars. And that's what chapter 11 is all about. It's those wars between two of those generals and trying to take over and reunite Alexander's empire before Rome comes in and takes over everything. So, we're going to study a little bit more of that tonight. Get excited. Chapter 9, first three quarters are Daniel praying for the sins of his people. What prompted him to pray?
The 7 years, is it?
70 years.
The exile.
Yeah, 70 years of the exile, prophesied by...
Jeremiah,
yeah. He's reading the text, he's reading Jeremiah the prophet, and you go, oh, time's almost up. Let's pray. So he does. And then right after that, who shows up?
The Gabriel. Russians.
Gabriel. Gabriel's got a message. Yeah, not the Russians, unfortunately. Gabriel shows up and he's got a message about 77s. We talked about the major interpretations of that. 77s and the 70th seven. And in particular, I'm going to read Daniel chapter 9, verse 26 following. So after the 62 weeks and the 7 weeks, so after 69 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. We talked about how that's probably Jesus, right, at the crucifixion. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 7. And after half of the 7, he shall put an end to sacrifices and offerings, and on the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. Those three verses factor into our discussion or interpretation of Daniel chapter 11, because a lot of these same things and these same words are going to crop up. You're going to see the prince, you're going to see the covenant, you're going to see an end to the sacrifices, you're going to see an abomination and an abomination of desolation. All of these things are kind of jam-packed into those three verses, and they're all spread out through Daniel chapter 11. So in your interpretation, you got to go, okay, are these talking about the same thing, or are they talking about similar things, and how would we distinguish them, how would we justify them? Daniel's 70-week prophecy in chapter 9 factors into chapter 11. Chapter 10, what we talked about last week, and what basically goes on in Daniel chapter 10.
Who knows?
Actually, a pretty good answer. But at the very least, what do we know for sure? Daniel's out walking along on the river.
After fasting for 3 weeks.
After fasting for 3 weeks. And what does he see?
He sees a guy floating above the water.
Yeah.
With, like, different characteristics.
Yeah, all bright. Flashing.
He has bronze feet. I remember that.
Got bronze feet, that's right. And the sound of his words like the sound of multitudes. Daniel falls on his face, and then he feels a hand on him. And he looks up, and there's a guy there. We talked about, is this the same guy who was out in the river, or is it a different guy? Told you why I think it's a different guy.
Is it's a guy that Michael helped.
It's a guy who's of the same type of as Michael, and it's a guy that Michael helped. And Michael's called a prince, and that's going to come up in our text today. So there's two different words for prince that they both get translated prince in chapters 10 and 11. One is tsar. Everybody say tsar.
No.
Come on, teach you Hebrew. Say tsar.
I'm saying it in my head.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, man.
We suck.
Tsar, the word for prince, probably is referring to angel, right? What?
Mm-hmm. It's not important. Keep going.
The other word for prince is nagid. Everybody say nagid.
You already know.
Dang. So close.
Really, your whole
lesson today? No. Nagid is more like commander, chief. More like what I think we would normally translate as prince. And so both of those two words get used and both get translated prince. But in the context, Tsar seems to be talking about angels. And Nagid seems to be talking about earthly human
guys.
So this prince who talks to Daniel says, you know, sorry, I was held up. I was fighting the prince of Persia, the Tsar of Persia.
You mean like the movie?
Yeah, and the video game. Took me 21 days. That's why you've been fasting for 3 weeks. God sent me here, you know, right away.
It takes
but
a lot longer than 21 days to beat the game.
It only took me 3 days. I don't know what you're talking about.
Are you kidding? You're joking.
And came to make you understand what has happened to your people and the vision. So I came to tell you what's going to happen in the future. And so Daniel says, all right, great. I'm paraphrasing, but... Again, no. When having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me, he said, O man greatly loved, fear not, peace be with you, be strong and of good courage. As he spoke to me, I was strengthened. Verse 20 is where we're going to pick up. Then he said, do you know why I've come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. He will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. That was where we ended last week, right? When he was about to tell Daniel what was inscribed in the book of truth. So what is inscribed in the Book of Truth is the subject of today's text. Now, preface. Things to watch out for. It's just a whole lot of military movements, mostly. It's describing this series of wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And so, and you're going to see the kings of the north, or the king of the north, that's the Seleucids. So if you look at your map, so the Seleucids are in yellow there. And the Ptolemies are in green.
Just like north?
Yeah, see how Seleucids, the only two that are in view that are really warring here are Seleucids and Ptolemies. And the reason is because what's right there where they meet?
The Dead Sea.
Dead Sea, and more importantly, Jerusalem, Israel, the Promised Land.
Lebanon. This is a shipping.
It's on the map.
Get my pointer out.
There's a good word for this. All right, you have like 60 maps now.
Yeah.
So you see over here, here's the Ptolemies over in Egypt. And the Seleucids are controlling all of this area. And right in here, where they meet, is little old Israel. Right? Jerusalem smack dab in the middle. That's a blown up map of Israel. That is right there. Okay.
Well played.
So, as the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are fighting and trying to gain land from each other, right? Seleucids are attacking Ptolemies, trying to press into Egypt and gain land. And the Ptolemies are fighting back, trying to press in, gain land. Israel's right in the middle of it. They're experiencing war going on. Also, it's kind of the exact same thing that's going on to this very day. Right? Israel's right in the middle of all of these other nations in Palestine, and they're trying to wipe them off the map, and they're trying to gain the land that the claim was promised them by their God Allah. But this is what's going on in 2nd century BC. And Daniel is, remember we talked about, kind of in that place of why hasn't the temple been rebuilt? Why are we still experiencing strife? I thought that the punishment of the exile was over. What's the deal, God? Why aren't you establishing your kingdom? Sort of thought. And the whole point of these last three chapters is, I'm going to do it. It's going to take a whole lot longer than you think, Daniel. You're not going to live to see it. You're going to die, and you're going to be resurrected in the kingdom. So, deal with that. If you want to know what's going to happen, I'll tell you. And he starts listing all the things that are going to happen. That's kind of the point of these three chapters. But in particular, take note of all the times when we're reading this that you see the words like rise up or stand up or arose or fell down or was destroyed or fell. There's a whole lot of empires rising and empires falling and kings rising and falling. And as we've talked about through the whole Book of Daniel, what's the point of the Book of Daniel? Who's the one doing all that rising and falling?
The king.
Yeah. And somebody just say it.
Like God's the one true king. He sets up and...
Yeah, he sets up and takes down kings.
That's it.
Yeah. God is the one who is in charge of all of these movements. He's the one making it happen. So, we're getting into the text now. So, this is what is written in the Book of Truth. There's no one who contends by my side against these, except Michael, your prince, and as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. So he's giving you a little bit of context of what's going on in his life, this angel. He and Michael, only guys who are fighting in this region, in the demonic realm that they're, this battle that they're in. Verse 2, and now I shall show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia. So, quick question. Who's talking?
Shall we know?
The guy?
Yeah, the same guy. The angel. Friend of Michael's, right? Who came to visit Daniel. No reason to suspect that the speaker changed. Some people posit that, and it's just silly. Three kings will arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. So, you read that, and your initial thought should be what? Three kings arise, and a fourth shall be greater than all of them.
Who are the kings?
Who are the kings, right? Yes. Who are these three kings, and who's the fourth? Two main interpretations on that. So, first one, possibly the three kings are Cyrus the Great, Cambyses, and Gautama, and the fourth is Darius the Great. So this is where your Persian history sort of crops up, which I know you guys have studied so much.
Mm-hmm.
Just yeah. Right on the tip of your tongue, you were thinking, yes, I was the Great Cambyses and Gautama. Of course,
history.
Those guys.
You read our mind.
Short version is you don't really need to know who those guys are as much. Darius the Great. So a couple main players in Persian history. Now, Cyrus the Great, you guys know. You've heard his name before. What did he do in the Bible?
He started the ball rolling.
Started the ball rolling on
Jerusalem.
Yeah, rebuilding the temple. Ezra 1, right? Cyrus the Great, according to the word of the Lord, to fulfill what was spoken by the prophets, said, Israel, you can go back to your land and build your temple. Another of the Persian kings that's mentioned in the Bible, the book of Esther, you got Xerxes or Ahasuerus. He's the one who, you know, sends off his wife Vashti and brings in Esther, and then his henchman Haman tries to kill off all the Jews, and he's just a dunce the whole time. Xerxes is a weird guy. His son, Artaxerxes, is also in the Bible. What did he do? We talked about him 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Killed people.
He did do that, but not really known in the Bible for it. I'll give you a hint, it's Nehemiah chapter 2.
The wall.
Yeah, Artaxerxes sends Nehemiah back to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. After Artaxerxes, there's a couple other kings, and then Darius the Third comes along. There's a few kings here that filter in between. And the way that Persian kings and Greek kings, all these ancient kings work, is you have a few dynastic names that kings pick up and repeat. So like Darius, you had Darius the First, he's Darius the Great, and you had Darius II, he did like squat. And then Darius the Third comes along and loses the whole empire. He had Xerxes I, he's the one who marries Esther, right? Xerxes II didn't do a whole lot of anything, Xerxes III also didn't do a whole lot of anything. Artaxerxes I, you had Artaxerxes II, and you had Artaxerxes III. Quite often, you'll have these particular names that get, just you throw a number after it, and it's their grandson or great-grandson or son or whatever. And it's these sort of dynastic names that flow through the history. You're going to see that in the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. So that's just how they did things back then, or at least how historians keep up with them. Where was I going with that? So, that's the other possible answer, too. There's three kings, and the fourth who comes up, who is great. Possibly he's talking about the three kings or the three major dynastic names of the Persians leading up to Greece taking over, which is Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes. The fourth king would be Darius III, who loses the empire to Alexander the Great. I think the first option is the best. Just FYI. That said, there's a whole lot of history that goes in. I'm trying to that should be good. Remind me, somebody run me through the basics again. So we've already been through it once, but just to be clear, what did, when Alexander takes over the whole world, how did it break up? Who got what?
His
Seleucids got like the east.
Yeah.
Ptolemy got the south.
Ptolemy got the south.
Lysimachus got northwest. Cassander got like north, west, west.
Yeah.
Basically, this right here.
West, northwest is
it. Yeah, okay, good. Make sure we're clear on that. Alright, that wasn't just like overnight. That took a few battles and wars and sort of settled on that after the called the Diadochi Wars. They were fighting over who's going to get what. Finally sort of settled on these four guys sort of getting the major groups, major land portions. Ptolemy is referred to as the king of the south. Seleucus and the Seleucids are referred to as the king of the north throughout this text. So what I'm going to do is read through verse 5, and then... Actually, I'll have one of you read through verse 5, and then I'm going to read the middle section. So, somebody read verses 2 through 5 for me.
And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points on the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside them. Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His domain will be a great dominion indeed.
All right. What did he just describe?
Persia being taken over by Greece and then being split up?
Yeah, yeah. So there's this three kings of Persia, one who comes along, better than all the rest, most expansive. That's why I think it's the first interpretation of Darius the Great is the best one, because he ruled Persia at the height of Persia's awesomeness. He had more victories, and he sort of started off the wars with Greece that got Alexander all pissed off at Persia. So Darius the Great makes a whole lot of sense for being this guy who becomes strong through his riches, stirs up the whole kingdom against Greece, and a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. That's Alexander the Great. Comes along a little bit later. So there's a gap of time in that reckoning between... So the strength of the first view is that Darius the Great makes a whole lot of sense for this great king. The strength of the second view, Darius the Third, is the one who actually loses the empire to Alexander, so there would be no gap of time with the second view. Pick which one makes more sense to you. Mighty king shall arise, Alexander the Great, who shall rule with great dominion, do as he wills. As soon as he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided towards the four winds of the heaven, describing the breakup into the four tetrarchs, Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, Ptolemy. And not according to his posterity, not according to his authority, because he died and didn't tell him who was going to take over, and they fought over it and eventually came to this conclusion. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger. He shall rule with his authority and shall be great authority. King of the south. You go to the second page. So here's how I tried to summarize it for you.
With a lot of words?
Yeah.
Holy.
Lots and lots of words.
Yeah.
So let me explain how I organize this. First of all, my normal outline, where I would outline, you know, this many verses and give you some sort of a heading to explain it, this is where it starts. Leading up to the death of Antiochus Epiphanes IV. It's either 11 verses 6 through 20, or 11 verses 6 through 35, or the entire rest of chapter 11, depending on how you're interpreting this passage. Not a whole lot of people agree on how to interpret it correctly. I like the first option, 11:6 through 20. I'll try and explain why as we go. And on the back page, the question is, end times, future, like, apocalypse stuff, is that 11:21 through 45, is 11:36 through 45, or is it just chapter 12? Again, I like the first option. And I'll explain why as we go. Guys that I really, really respect and grew up reading go with the second option, that the switch between past and future happens at verse 35, 36. So, I think that's for what it's worth. The Syrian Wars is a series of six wars that took place between the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid empires in the 3rd and 2nd century BC. These conflicts drained the material and manpower of both parties and led to their eventual destruction and conquest by Rome and Parthia. They are briefly mentioned in the biblical books of the Maccabees. I'll be clear on that. Like what? That's what's being described in chapter 11, is the Syrian Wars, or at least partly. The events here can be variously attributed to different moves made by different Seleucid and Ptolemaic kings. Nobody's named, right? It just says a king of the north, king of the south, and then the king's son, and then the king's son. So it gets very complicated. Interpreters are heavily divided, but in general, the big question for conservative interpreters are as follows. Which section of verses describes Antiochus Epiphanes? Is it verses 10 through 20, or is it verses 21 through 35? Because Antiochus Epiphanes is kind of a big character that we can nail down. He did a whole lot of specific things, particularly with the Jews. And so, trying to figure out which of these verses describe him and his actions. And then what sections, if any, refer to still future events. Right. We're also going to assume as interpreters that he's giving us this in chronological order. So he starts with Alexander the Great's breakup of his empire. He then treks through history. So everything progresses. He's not recycling back and describing anything, because that would just make it even more complicated. And it's complicated enough already. What I did was I traced every time a king switches clearly, I put kingdom. So I traced kingdom of the north, Seleucids, and then kingdom of the south, Ptolemies. Every time a king switches clearly, I put a new dash marker and second king mentioned, third king mentioned, fourth king mentioned, etc. Same with the kings of the south. Now, if a king does something, if you go back to this page, the king does something and you're like, okay, it's starting to look like this is a different king. Either because there's been so much time in between, or because he's doing something really, really weird, or because many interpreters would say that a break of time is there, I put a little question mark after his event. So, example, the kings of the north on the back page mobilize extremely large army for war and will not stand, question mark, verse 25. The question mark means, is this still the second king of the south mentioned, or is this now the third king of the south? And he just, it didn't tell us that it's his son or his grandson or something like that. Did that track?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of? If there's two question marks and that one further removed, is this another new king or is this still the same king? It's based on the text, it just says king of the south, but maybe it's a somebody further down in the descendant line. And I just traced every major action of each of these guys. So then the question is, which king is it? Then, at the end of this double column thing, I gave you the Seleucid kings that we know from history in order, and the Ptolemaic kings that we know from history in order. From the first king down through Antiochus 50, or Antiochus 5, gave you the years that they're reigning. So you can sit down and sort of trek through this too and figure out where you think they line up. But what I'm basically going to do is read through the text, and I want you to sort of be following along with this. I tried to line them up when things were happening concurrently, and try and keep straight which king is acting. And what I'll do is I'll just stop and explain portions of the text that are at least important or have some clear meaning or application. And after that, we can try and clear up any other confusion that still exists afterward. With me? I feel like I'm already...
working on it.
I'm already lost. I'm going to try. Verse 6. And I'm reading the ESV, different translations render lots of these very differently, so do your best to stay in tune. Verse 6. After some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north and make an agreement. But she shall not retain her strength of her, and he in his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, and he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. So the first king refuses an alliance with the daughter of the south. First king of the north refuses an alliance with the daughter of the king of the south. The first king mentioned of the south is the daughter who goes up. He refuses the alliance. So verse 7. And from a branch from her, so from her descendants, one shall arise in his place. His being king of the south's place, right? She's the daughter of the king of the south, so her son is going to take the place of the king of the south. So this is the second king of the south mentioned. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, and for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. So, what happened? The second king of the south plunders the king of the north, the Seleucids, takes all of his gold and silver stuff, takes it back to Egypt with him. And he stays there for a while. The king of the north comes into the realm of the king of the south and then goes right back. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Verse 10. His sons, whose sons? King of the north's sons, Seleucids. Sorry. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep overflowing, keep coming and overflow the pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. So one of these sons mobilizes with his brothers, wages war against the king of the south's fortress. So this is the second king of the north mentioned. With me? Verse 11. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north. He shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. So, king of the south comes out, wages war, and wins. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. The king of the north shall again rise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. The king of the north rises up another big multitude. Everybody with me so far?
Just trying to keep up.
Yeah. That's so confusing. Verse 14. In those times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violence among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. So, during this time, while these two kings are going back and forth, Daniel, your own people are going to lift themselves up in order to fulfill some vision, but they're going to fail. So they're going to lead some sort of an uprising or a revolt or try and fight back somehow, but they're not going to succeed. This is one of the main reasons I think that Antiochus Epiphanes is this second king mentioned.
Because of
the second king of the north. The uprising seems to be referring to the Maccabean revolt, I think. So we know the history of the Maccabees, that's what your picture is on the front of the picture. Antiochus Epiphanes, as he's waging war and doing his thing with the Seleucid Empire, the Jews are not particularly happy because he's reforming their culture. He's invading and replacing it with his own culture. He's tearing down their places of worship. He's tearing down their altars, and he's desecrating their altars and things like this. And this is a picture of the martyrdom of the seven Maccabees. Essentially, he goes in and kills seven of the priest family, Levites, and it sets off the father of the Maccabees, not Judas, Matthias Maccabeus. The Matthias Maccabeus has enough. And the guy, one of the generals of Antiochus Epiphanes' armies comes in, and he's going to sacrifice a pig on the altar of the temple. And if you know Jewish rules, pigs are unclean animals. The idea of sacrificing a pig on the altar is the biggest insult, the most profane thing you can do on that altar. So Matthias Maccabeus goes up and kills this guy before he can sacrifice the pig and sets off the Maccabean revolt. So Matthias Maccabeus and his sons then start leading this uprising, this revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes.
Okay, hold on. So sacrificing a pig on a cross is offensive to Jews. Is that what I heard?
On the altar. On the where they would make their animal sacrifices for their sins. Which they don't do anymore, present day. But back then, you kill animals in certain ways on altars to atone for sins.
Okay, right.
And so killing a pig is profaning that altar. So that sets off the Maccabean revolt. I think that's verse 10, verse 14. The people, your own people, the Jews, is the Maccabean revolt. And that's why I think verses 10, the second king mentioned, which is verses 10 through 20, is Antiochus Epiphanes. That's why I lean towards that. I'm going to bring up the reasons why lots of people will lean other ways in just a second. So verse 14, your people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Verse 15, then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. Again, this is... seems like Antiochus Epiphanes standing in the glorious land, the beautiful land, Jerusalem, waging war, destroying the things of the Jews. Verse 17, he shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom. He shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand to be to his advantage. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them. But a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon it, and he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land. This, I think, again, lines up with something that happened to Antiochus Epiphanes. So, Antiochus Epiphanes is trying to take over Egypt. He's headed to Egypt. He's about to make this big assault on Egypt. And the commander from Rome shows up on a ship and sort of cuts him off at the pass before he gets there. So he's stopping him right there at the mouth of the Nile. As Antiochus Epiphanes is coming across, trying to take Egypt, commander from Rome stops him on the beach and famously stops him and says, the Senate in Rome needs to know if you're going to submit to their authority or not. And Antiochus Epiphanes goes, well, let me check with my people and I'll get back to you. And the commander famously draws a circle around him in the sand. And he says, I'm going to need an answer before you exit that circle. And if you exit the circle before I get that answer, we will take that as an act of war.
Wow.
And so Antiochus Epiphanes was like, well, I guess I'm going to go ahead and be subject to Rome then. So this is how Rome just sort of took over, and their might was legendary. Titus Epiphanes knew he couldn't stand up to Rome. So that, I think, is the verse 18. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastland and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. I think that is that interaction with him on the beach. I forget the commander's name from Rome, but it's in... I'll say it wrong if I try and guess. He shall turn his face back toward the fortress of his own land. So he sends him back home, essentially. He doesn't get to take over Egypt like he wanted. Essentially, Rome beat him to conquering Egypt. But he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Again, the way that Antiochus Epiphanes died was he was on his way back to his fortress, back to his castle. He got very, very sick, probably dysentery is what most historians will say. And he died pretty quickly afterward on the road, on his way back to... So he didn't die in battle or anything like that, which I think, again, verse 19 sort of lines up with the way Antiochus Epiphanes died. He stumbles and falls, not to be found. Makes sense to me. Okay. Guys, thank you. Verse 20. So, after the second king of the north dies, verse 20, then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. So, a third king is mentioned. He rises up, only king for a few days, then he dies. Neither in anger nor in battle. After that guy, verse 21, in his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So, there's a whole other group that will say, verse 21 is where Antiochus Epiphanes' reign started, and the previous one is his father, Antiochus III. I'd say 21 forward is actually future. This is the Antichrist, the little horn, the beast from Revelation 13. So, in terms of where in history are we are in between verse 20 and 21, or in between verse 19 and 20. I think there's a linguistic justification for a break of time there, and that's where I put it. Take that for what it's worth. We'll keep going. I'll try and explain why lots of people will say this is Antiochus Epiphanes as we're going from 21 onward. In his place shall arise a contemptible person whose royal majesty has not been given. It shall come without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. This is an interesting verse. The prince of the covenant. What prince of the covenant is he talking about? Hint, think back to chapter 9.
Well, which word is it?
Prince of the Covenant. Right?
Is it Sar or is it...
Good question. Is it Sar or is it not? It's Nagid, which is the same one as in chapter 9. It says, a Messiah, a prince, will come. And then a few verses later, and he, even the people of the prince who is to come, or somebody else, will make a strong covenant with the many for 1 week, 1:7. So the prince of the covenant here, I think, is referring to the crucifixion from back in the 70 weeks prophecy. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. I think this is referring to verse 25 of chapter 9 in the 70 weeks prophecy. So go back and look at the 70 weeks prophecy again to see how all that lines up. I don't have time to cover it right now, but... and from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. He shall become strong with a small people. Again, this seems to be lining up with the second half of the 70 weeks prophecy. A strong covenant was made with the many for 1 week. From the time an alliance was made with him, he shall act deceitfully and become strong with people. Without warning, He shall come into the richest part of the province. He shall do what is neither his father's or his father's father's have done, scattering among them plunder and spoil and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up the power, his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with him, exceedingly great, mighty army shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away. Many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail. For the end is yet to be at the time appointed. So I think this is all talking about future Antichrist. He's going to be interacting with a yet future, quote-unquote, king of the south. And lots of people will pin this on Antiochus Epiphanes. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant. And he shall work his will and return to his own land. Verse 29. This is where most people will say, this is how we know it's Antiochus Epiphanes. At the appointed time, he shall return and come into the south. It shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. This is, again, what Antiochus Epiphanes did. Tried to take over, comes back, and instead rails against the Jews. Take action against the Holy Covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and shall upset the abomination that makes desolate. This is what most people will say is the Judas Maccabeus instance. Right? Taking away the regular sacrifices, profaning, making the abomination of desolation, sacrificing the pig on that altar. I think this is future kingdom, and I think it's referring back to chapter 9, verse 27. I think all of this is expansion of chapter 9, verse 27. Putting it into the sacrifices that a yet future king is going to do. Forces from him shall appear, profane the temple, take away the burnt offerings, set up the abomination of desolation that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action, and the wise among the people shall make many understand. Though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, made white, until the end of the time, for it still awaits the appointed time. This uprising of the righteous, or the... How does he describe them? The wise people, those who understand. That's where most people say that's the Maccabean Revolt. I think that's future, that's tribulation saints. So, that's for what it's worth. Until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. Verse 36 is where most conservative interpreters will agree, alright, we're switching to future now. So, even the guys who used to disagree with me on 21 through 35 will now agree with me on what 36 through 45 means. And the king shall do as he wills. So this is a new king in their eyes. I think it's the same guy. Keep going. He shall exalt himself, magnify himself above every other god. He shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished. For what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers, or to the one who one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortress instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones, costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many, and shall divide the land for a price. This is all stuff that the future Antichrist is going to do. It's the little horn, right? Boasting great things against the god Yahweh. Right. Taking for himself things that are not gods and worshiping them. Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack. But the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall. But these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom, Moab, many parts of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against these countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become a ruler of the treasurers of gold and of silver and all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans, the Cushites, shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with a great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. He shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. That, I think, is all going to happen to the future Antichrist king, what have you. A few little things to pull out and make note of, and then we'll be done. I'll let you guys compare and contrast verse 31 with the 70 weeks prophecy on your own time. Verses 32 to 35. So, whether you think this is Antiochus Epiphanes persecuting 2nd century BC Jews, or if you think it's a future king who's persecuting tribulation saints, what is the description of these people? He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. The wise among the people shall make many understand. Though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive help. How would you describe these people? What's happening to them, and what is their character?
They're nice guys.
Yeah. How does it describe them? Verse 33.
Wise.
Wise. The wise among the people shall make many understand. And what's the king doing to them?
He's being mean.
He's being mean. Sword, flame, captivity, plunder. He's killing them. They're dying in horrific ways. And yet, verse 34, when they stumble, they shall receive help. A little help is what the ESV says. Not a lot of help, just a little help. A little help is enough. So, right in the midst of this just huge list of confusing future history for Daniel, he's promised not green pastures and life being easy. He's promised, yeah, your people are going to lead a revolt. They're going to be trying to kill you. And you know, it's not going to be great for you. But you'll receive help. And that's where our hope is. Our hope is in the God who helps. And then we're going to see next week in chapter 12, our real hope is in the resurrection. He straight up says, in the resurrection, that's when the real promises will be fulfilled. That's when it's all coming. That's what you're waiting for. It's the resurrection. So that's chapter 12. That's next week. Chapter 11 is kind of one of those things that you just have to get through because it's so confusing. If you sit down and actually study it, it can get really interesting. Particularly, I would recommend just going on Wikipedia and Googling, or just looking on Wikipedia a list of Seleucid and Ptolemaic kings, and just trying to piece together a little bit. Read about what they did, like how each king died, some of the things that they're known for, and see if you can line it up. It's a fun little like puzzle, sort of. But anyway, that's chapter 11. Oof. It's almost as bad as I was expecting. So. Chapter 12 is a lot more straightforward. And next week we will finish out Daniel. Fun stuff.